All right, I will get started. So my lab uses yeast as our model organism, and we do experimental evolution. I'm a biologist, I'm not a theoretician or a mathematician. So you'll understand where my work is coming from and the limits of my ability to answer some of your questions. But we're trying to understand the adaptive landscape and trying to understand evolution at the molecular level. So we approached this project in light of Muller's classic model. So this model is almost 80 years old now. And Muller posited that change occurs by sequential occurrence and then selection of new clones. And a prediction from that model would be is that the population will consist largely of a single clone, other than during periods when an adaptive shift is occurring. And this results in, so this is clonal replacement and results in something that people refer to as adaptive sweeps. And so if we imagine this is our population of individuals over time, and we're looking at some slice through the population, in this case, we're looking just after a mutation has fixed. We can imagine, you know, a mutation arises randomly based on the background mutation frequency that provides an adaptive advantage in whatever particular condition this population might be growing. Due to that advantage, it will expand as a fraction of the population. And at some point, will fix within the population. And then on top of A, will occur another mutation randomly, B, which then fixes, and then subsequently C occurs on top of that. And so in this classic model, you have this kind of sequential succession where mutations occur on the previously fixed background. An alternative, I don't necessarily want to say competing hypothesis, is one of clonal interference, where again we have our individuals evolving over time, but in this case, say mutation A arises, prior to it actually fixing in the population, another mutation arises, C. We also had B, which kind of winked in and out of existence, and that expands within the population, and then D comes along and expands, and actually in this case fixes. And so the difference here between this and the classic model is that there are mutations which, while adaptive, have been lost during the course of evolution. And so not all adaptive mutations make it into the final successful lineage. Many of the mutations will be essentially eliminated. Now, the reason that we started thinking about the problem from this perspective of Muller's classic model versus this alternative of clonal interference is that the foundational work in yeast experimental evolution, which was done in the early 1980s by Paquin and Adams, they observed changes in the frequency of neutral markers that they were monitoring, and they kind of described a sawtooth pattern that they saw, and from that they inferred that there was clonal replacement. That is, they inferred that there were adaptive sweeps. Now, more recent theoretical data coming out in kind of the early 2000s modeled this process based on population size and mutation rate. Essentially, those two parameters, plus, of course, the benefit that adaptive mutations might give in terms of how much fitter they might make you than the progenitor from which you derived. And that theoretical work predicted that for populations of the size that Paquin and Adams were dealing with in their experimental evolutions, that you would expect to, in fact, get clonal interference and not clonal replacement. So we believe that Paquin and Adams had interpreted their data incorrectly. Now, they interpreted it incorrectly because they had a very kind of low-resolution lens. It was just looking at a neutral marker frequency. There was nothing better that they could do at the time. The key point is that the next 30 years of work had been kind of based on that principle that there were adaptive sweeps occurring in these microbial evolution experiments. So what we wanted to determine is, Yes.
Saying it's the wrong resolution is that under the assumption there are sweeps, but also clonal interference. In other words, sometimes a clone sweeps, other times it gets interfered with.
I think both of those things are true. Essentially, there's just a spectrum between this and clonal replacement. Actually, from here, you can go in the opposite direction even further with a higher mutation rate, whereby you might even get multiple mutations accumulating in these lineages, which then become extinct. They were only able to look at the presence of this single neutral marker and its frequency. And because of that, I think they could have either inferred there's no evolution or there are adaptive sweeps as they saw it. And it was hard for them to make any kind of intermediate distinction. But we wanted to provide empirical data that would either support this or support clonal replacement, or indeed maybe something which is more extreme than this, called the multiple mutations model. The other thing that we were interested in is the idea from Sewell Wright, again in the early 1930s, of the adaptive landscape, an evolutionary trajectory across that. Now, the adaptive landscape really serves as a metaphor. And the idea is that you're mapping genotype versus fitness, and there will be some global optimum, which is the most fit you can be under some particular condition. And then there might be other local optima. And you might, for example, have a population starting out at this genotype. Selection occurs over time, and depending on what mutations it gets first, might alter which direction it goes on this adaptive landscape. And you could imagine, if it ends up here for some reason, that it's, while not precluded, depending upon the population size and the mutation rate, it's at least unlikely to ever go back through the fitness valley and make it up to the global optimum. And it's a powerful and pervasive metaphor that's been at use in evolutionary biology for a long time, but the empirical data are at best sparse. Some people have done some very focused studies on particular proteins where they've looked at the interaction of a few residues within a single protein, but there aren't really any experimental evolutionary data that shed a lot of light on the idea of the adaptive landscape. So we wanted to see whether we could shed some empirical data or generate some empirical data to shed light on this. So we needed a system. And our experimental system needs to identify, count, and isolate clones in an evolving population. So we're going to use yeast. Yeast, they have a small genome, 12 megabases. It's a well-understood genome. It was the first sequenced eukaryote in 1996. There exists a knockout deletion collection for yeast. We know something about just about everything in yeast, so it makes a great model. Short cell division time, so we can get lots of generations in a relatively short amount of time. It can also exist stably as a haploid or a diploid, and it can propagate asexually, so we don't need to worry about recombination. So all we did simply was to integrate in either red, green, or yellow fluorescent protein into the genome, or a gene encoding those into the genome, into otherwise isogenic yeast strains. So now we have identical yeast, but they're colored differently, and we're going to use these to monitor evolution. And the benefit here is we can use fax analysis to both sort and count cells. So if we say we want all the red cells from this particular time point, we can do that. Or if we want to just know how many red, green, and yellow cells there are, we can do that too. So this is how the experiment works. We're using a chemostat. So it's a continuous culture system. So fresh medium goes in constantly. There's a culture overflow, which means that both medium and cells are leaving the vessel constantly. And what happens is that you have a constant population size in the vessel. And you can grow this for many months, so many hundreds of generations. You have to use a limiting nutrient in a chemostat, and the limiting nutrient that we're using is glucose. This is being provided at 0.08%. The reason that we went with glucose is this is exactly what Paquin and Adams used for their limiting nutrient, and most of the chemostat work in yeast has been done using limiting carbon source, although more recently people have used limiting nitrogen or limiting sulfur. We have asexual cerevisiae. Yes?
They also mutate to more efficiently use the nutrient and increase their density so that the population size need not stay fixed. Or do you confirm that by measurement and extent?
So there's a couple of things that we can measure here. One is we can measure the residual substrate, so the residual amount of glucose, which gives us an idea of how efficiently is the glucose being used. You see very slight fluctuations when adaptation occurs, and of course we're looking in this experiment for adaptation to occur, but by and large the population stays the same, and it's really dictated by what's called the dilution rate, which is how rapidly are you replacing the medium in the vessel. And the dilution rates we typically use are about 0.15, so that means 0.15 volumes of the culture medium is being replaced per hour, and that sets the doubling time for the cells. So the yeast are being propagated asexually here, so we don't need to worry about alleles arising in different lineages combining through mating. And they're haploids, so any mutation that arises, we don't have to worry about is it recessive or is it dominant. If it was recessive, presumably we wouldn't observe it having an adaptive benefit. So this means that any potentially adaptive mutation is already unmasked with regards to its phenotype being expressed. So we imagine, you know, we have a population of yeast cells. Randomly, by chance, one of them gets a mutation that makes it slightly fitter, and then selection and time, selection being the limiting glucose, is going to lead to an expansion in its allele frequency in the population. Yeah?
Is this culture in exponential phase?
It is growing as fast as it is able under these conditions, which is dictated by this dilution rate. So if we're replacing 0.15 volumes of the culture per hour, then it takes about 6.5 hours or so to replace the entire volume, and so that dictates how fast the cells have to divide. This medium is a minimal medium, so a doubling time of about 6 or so hours is about as fast as they can do it in that medium. If you grow them in rich medium in batch culture, they can actually do it in more like 90 minutes. But you can't really do that in the chemostat. You can't get them to go that fast in the chemostat.
So do you have to worry about selecting for yeast that sticks to the walls?
That's a very good question. People have observed, sometimes you'll get, there's a phenotype in yeast called flocculation, where yeast have sticky proteins on their surface, and so they will aggregate. And in addition to aggregating to one another, they can aggregate to the glass. We have not had that problem in our chemostats. I know people who have, where essentially they have to throw away the experiment and start again. This culture overflow that we have actually is a tube that goes off to a vacuum pump, and it's constantly sucking, so it keeps the level at the same height. But the force with which it's sucking basically means this stuff is being stirred up all the time. And it's being stirred up vigorously enough that we never really observe anything sticking to the walls. I should note, we have very large populations here, so we're not concerned about the effects of drift at all. We're only concerned about adaptation and expansion due to adaptation. So, if clonal replacement is going to apply in this particular experiment. So if we seed our chemostat with equal numbers of red, green, and yellow cells, if clonal replacement occurs, we might expect one of the colors, in this case red, to pick up one of these adaptive mutations. And then after some amount of time, the culture will essentially be all red, and it will persist as all red for the rest of the experiment. Alternatively, if we're having clonal interference, again, we start out with equal numbers of each of the three different colored cells, but maybe what might happen is that one of the colors expands, but then at a later time point, we actually observe the opposite, that maybe this color has contracted and another color has expanded, and that might change again. So we might see some kind of dynamic interplay between the different colors rather than one color just overtake the entire culture following the first adaptive event. So this was our first result. This was our first experiment. I think you can see clearly that we can reject clonal replacement as being the driving force behind adaptation in this particular culture, because we're seeing, for example, an expansion in the green population, an expansion in the red population, yellow expands, red actually comes back a little bit here, and yellow is almost fixed at the end, although not quite. So we're observing many adaptive events, minimum of 5, possibly more. You know, we only have a resolution of 3 colors. And this is over the course of about 440 generations. Second experiment, similar principles, slightly different outcome, but you can see we have expansion in yellow, possibly in green, one in red, and then red ends up fixing. We actually did 8 of these experiments, and all of them showed clear, what we call unequivocal evidence of clonal interference. None of them showed, following the first adaptive event, clonal replacement. So some general observations. We saw adaptive events roughly every 50 to 100 generations, or at least based on seeing some color expand. And that's similar to what Paquin and Adams reported. It's just that they thought they resulted in adaptive sweeps. But it's clear to us that clonal interference is playing an important role in shaping the population structure. One thing that I should note, even if in an experiment a color does fix, that doesn't necessarily mean that there was an individual clone with that color that fixed within that subpopulation. There could be multiple different clones that just happen to have the same color. And because we only have 3 colors, that's the limit of our resolution.
So how can you say it's conclude for clonal interference from these? My question is a little bit, so how sure can you be that these individual slopes are something really deterministic? It's from lots of things going on, you know. Why is this not noise?
Why is it not noise? So the reason I think it's not noise is the population is very large. It's about 10 to the 9. And for each one of these events, we count about 20,000 cells. And actually, we did some experiments where we put in known amounts of each of the 3 different colors, counted them multiple times, and we find that these particular values are pretty robust. So then the question is, I think there's 2 competing possibilities. One is, it's noise that would be a result of drift, right, where you just can have some kind of random fluctuations in allele frequency based on who happened to get sucked out of the chemostat before somebody else. With a population size of 10 to the 9, I don't think that drift can play an issue at all, and theoretically it cannot. So we conclude, or we believe, that any population expansion that we observe here must be the result of adaptation. And if we, let me just finish this point. If we see multiple expansions within different colors, to us that means we're observing multiple adaptive events in the absence of seeing any of the prior ones go to fixation, which to me is the definition of clonal interference.
So have you, can one check this? I mean, is this reproducible? So if you take, for example, if you freeze this at generation 70, will you see, and you do 5 replicates, will you see the red one going always up?
So I have data that I'm going to get to concerning individual clones taken from this population where we demonstrate increases in fitness and demonstrate that they have adapted. If we took population at this point and started a new chemostat from that, I can pretty much guarantee you that it will not recapitulate this. And I think we would be surprised if it did.
How about the short times? Expected to recapitulate anything once new mutations come in.
Right.
But at short times, where you just have exponential growth, you would. So the question is, for how long would it track the same?
That's a good question. So in short-term pairwise chemostats to test relative differences in fitness, we see reproducible changes in fitness when we take 2 pairwise clones. Now, if we took this population and used it to see the chemostat and followed that for maybe 50 generations at high resolution, the question would then be, will we see a reproducible change?
Right.
I don't know. We haven't done that. I would predict that it would be largely reproducible, but absent data, I can't guarantee.
Also, along the same line, so if one takes this optimistically, one would want to just try to fit this dynamics with a bunch of exponentials. You know, exponential fits are not very stable at all.
Right.
But so did you try fitting it to a bunch of exponentials?
We have not. There is a graduate student in David Sigmund's group up at Stanford, and he's been playing around with one of the populations, unfortunately not this one, where he is trying to fit to understand, even within a given color, how many other possible clones there might be. And he has some data that, you know, makes predictions, but until we've generated empirical sequence data from those, it's hard to know how close his predictions are. And we're going to generate some sequencing data, and I'll come to that later on when I talk about some of our future.
I'm just curious
goals.
Whether, you know, the number here is, you know, 3, in which maybe one can fit, mm-hmm. or 30, in which
right.
one certainly cannot.
My
it's when you just look, for example, at this first, like where the red one
uh-huh.
seems to be positively selected. This must
yeah.
This must be quite strong, right? Because it's only like 30 generations or something.
Right,
like,
and we do see.
So this must be like a few percent.
Oh, we see way more than a few percent.
It's like 10% frequency change over the 30 generations. So
right.
Yeah, at least a few percent, right? But then, so you would, if this is to be determined by another more successful clone.
Uh huh.
I would expect to see now one of the other colors taking over with a similar or higher slope.
Oh,
no, it just peters out. So that's
well,
why
but, I'm but think about it. You have the population, the things against which the subsequent clones is competing is different than what we had in the chemostat in the first place. The population, while a chemostat is put forth as this continuous culture vessel under a constant environment, the thing within that environment that changes is the nature of the population itself. So when this yellow clone is beginning to compete, it's competing against something that was already much, much fitter than what we had in the beginning. And so you might predict that there's going to be some kind of asymptotic behavior whereby your ability to be better than your the things against which you're competing is going to diminish over time, right? If this is, and we know that some people say, are 30% fitter than their progenitors. Well, being 30% fitter than that again is more difficult because there's got to be some physical limit to how much more fit you can become in a constant environment. You can't infinitely get fitter and eventually be able to divide an infinite number of times within an infinitesimal amount of time, right? So there has to be some kind of trajectory as you're approaching either a global or a local fitness optimum. As you approach that, I presume the curve diminishes, so the rate at which you approach it decreases. Okay. So, we decided that we wanted to characterize this population more rigorously and in more depth. So, as I pointed out, we believed there were at least 5 adaptive events, very possibly more. The one that resulted in the expansion of the green population, one for the red, etc. So we went in and sorted out these particular subpopulations. So we put this population sample through the FACS sorter and said, give us all of the green cells, or this population said, give us all of the red cells, right? And sort those into a separate tube for further characterization. And then what we're going to do is we're going to take those particular sorted subpopulations. And we just took 7 clones from each of those. That was based purely on practical purposes for having to do the experiments in the chemostat. And then we're going to compete a sorted clone versus an original wild-type clone, where we would make sure that the wild-type clone was marked with a different color than the sorted clone, because then we can follow them both in the chemostat. And we just choose the fittest, the most fit clone of the 7 that we chose. So we say this clone will be representative of the adaptive event that happened to occur in that sorted subpopulation. And then we go to the Selexa sequencing machine and generate a genome-wide list of mutations. Say, can we determine the molecular underpinnings that led to that being more fit? So these are the relative fitness coefficient data. We tried actually competing either the sorted population itself, so which is just a a mixture, essentially. So, for example, this is kind of M1, M2, M3, M4, M5 from that picture earlier. So competing either the entire sorted population against the wild type parent, or the most fit clone from that population against the wild type parent. So there's a couple of things to note here. One is that in every single case, we see increased fitness relative to the wild type progenitor. And the second thing is, in at least two of these populations, we suspect that the adaptive clone is not necessarily close to being the majority of that population based on the difference in improved fitness between the population sample versus the best clone. We also tried competing each adaptive clone against the prior adaptive clone. So for the first one, this is merely a recapitulation of these data. The scale is slightly changed. So this is against wild type. This is the second adaptive clone against the first one, and they're actually pretty much equal fitness. This is the third one against the second one, fourth one against the third, fifth one against the fourth. And by and large, although not exclusively, we're still seeing increases in fitness relative to the prior adaptive clone that existed. So the fitness of subsequent adaptive mutations versus the original parent is not necessarily increasing over time. So you can see that this one, this is an interesting point, M5, its fitness relative to the original wild-type clone is not as high, although we would need to determine that that's significantly not as high, as M4 versus the original parent. However, if you compete M5 directly in a head-to-head competition against M4, it is more fit. And Paquin and Adams actually observed this type of behavior, this what they called non-transitivity. So clone 1 is always guaranteed to be more fit than clone 0, clone 2 more fit than clone 1, clone 3 more fit than clone 2. But clone 3 is not necessarily guaranteed to be more fit than clone 0 because the population is changing over time and the conditions under which you're competing is changing. So we went to the Selexa sequencer. This is actually a couple of years ago now that we generated these data, and generated between about 10 and 25 million reads, about three quarters of which typically map. Most of the ones that don't map are due to sequencing errors. So you can see the kind of coverage we're getting is somewhere between 20 and 50x coverage of the nuclear genome, much higher coverage of the mitochondrial genome. And in general, we cover the entire genome. There's a small region of the genome that we did not cover, and it appears that our progenitor strain is missing about 300 base pairs relative to the reference sequence. But other than that, it's essentially identical. So we are able to sequence all five of the adaptive clones that we got to high coverage, and then we can start asking what are the mutations. In addition to identifying mutations, if you just look at coverage, raw sequence coverage across the genome, you can identify regions where there's been copy number changes, where a particular gene, for example, might have been amplified. Yeast has this curious arrangement of two of the hexose transporters, HXT6 and 7, such that they're in a tandem array. And what that means is when you have these two transporters arranged like this, is that you can have mitotic recombination that, if you get them lined up slightly incorrectly against the sister chromatid, then you can end up getting a recombination event that results in three copies going to one cell and one copy going to the other. So it's quite easy to generate amplifications of this locus. We see this is an example from one of our clones where this has now got up to somewhere around fourfold coverage, so about four copies compared to, you can see the surrounding DNA has not been amplified. So what about the genome-wide mutation list? So we actually find relatively few mutations present in these clones that have evolved. So this was quite early on. This was at 56 generations, and then this is somewhere around 400 generations. So a relatively small number of mutations. And there's some relatively, or some clear things to note here. First, we see three mutations in a gene called MTH1. The mutations are all nonsense mutations, so they all result in a stop codon. It's a slightly different position. Obviously, they're in different colors, so we know that they're independent mutations. MTH1 actually transcriptionally represses expression of the hexose transporters. Now, the hexose transporters, of course, are what are responsible for drawing glucose into cell. So if you're evolving under limiting glucose, anything you can do to have more hexose transporter is likely to be adaptive. So one way is by reducing function of MTH1, which we've seen independently three times. A second way is, as I pointed out on the previous slide, to actually amplify the hexose transporters themselves, just have more copies of them. Assuming they continue to be transcribed, then you know we produce more transcript, more protein, more membrane real estate is put forward to actually bring in glucose into the cell. We see that, again, independently twice. Actually, when we looked at hexose transporter copy number throughout the experiment, we also see that by the end of it, not necessarily this clone, but the green subpopulation itself has clones within it that have a hexose transporter amplification as well. Next point is, none of the mutations present in the second red clone that we isolated are present in the first one, so they must be independent lineages. And the same is also true for the two yellow clones. Neither of those two mutations there are present within the mutations found in the second yellow clone, so they, in addition, must also be independent lineages. Yes?
So are these all the mutations?
These are all the mutations.
So how about synonymous ones? So there were no synonymous?
Let's have a look. Do we have anything that's synonymous here? Silent, right there. That was a synonymous mutation. So by and large, no. It was somewhat surprising to us. So the majority of them are within genes, although you have to remember yeast, about 80% of its DNA encodes genes. It has very densely packed genes with fairly short promoters in front of them. And of those things within genes, most of them resulted either in amino acid changes, stop codons, or frame shifts. The other one here is actually there was a transposon event which resulted in the insertion of an LTR element into this particular gene. But yeah, this is all the mutations that are present, as far as we can tell based on analysis of the sequence data. So the question then is, okay, we have all of these mutations, but which of them are adaptive, right? I told you that we're propagating yeast asexually, so there's no recombination. So a mutation may either be adaptive, or it might be a hitchhiker. Cell just happened to have already got a mutation, and then an adaptive mutation occurred on top of that, and the first mutation just came along for the ride. And it'd be nice to know which are adaptive and which are not. Because this is yeast and yeast are straightforward to work with genetically, we can take our adaptive clone, cross it to a wild-type parent, make them go through meiosis, do this as many times as we need to actually segregate out the single mutation. So if we have five mutations, we might need to do these back crosses a couple of times to segregate mutations out so that they're in a strain singly. Then we can cross this single mutation spore to a wild-type parent, again go through meiosis, and now we get the mutation to segregate. We'll get two wild-type spores and two spores carrying a single mutation, or carrying a single mutation. And then we can do pairwise fitness competitions. We can take our single mutation spore, compete it in a chemostat against a wild-type, and as a control we can take the sister wild-type spores and compete those against the wild type. And then if the single mutation spore actually is an adaptive mutation, we expect over time the frequency of the population carrying that mutation to increase in our pairwise fitness competition. And these are short-term experiments now. These are over like 20 to 25 generations. So we're not really looking at new evolution. We're just looking in a pairwise fashion, which is the more fit. Or if the mutation is not adaptive, or also in the case of the wild-type control, then we expect them roughly to continue at about a 50-50 level in the chemostat.
So,
yes?
Would this assay rule out epistatic effects?
It will not rule out epistatic effects, no. And that's going to be very important. It will allow us to find only those mutations that singly provide an adaptive benefit. It will not tell us those mutations which require the presence of another mutation to exert an additional adaptive benefit.
But you still sort out linkage versus epistasis. This would still have to be done for these pairs, right?
Or right. So to do all pairwise combinations, yes, that's required to determine epistasis. And I should note, you know, the assay is not perfect. For things that we don't find as being adaptive, either it's because there's an epistasis relationship when it's separated out singly, or our ability to determine it as being adaptive is precluded by the assay not being precise enough. So these are the results for the segregation of all of the single mutations. And so you can see we had one, two, three different alleles of MTH1, and as we might have predicted, all three of them are significantly more fit than the parent. The two alleles of the hexose transporter amplification, one here and one here, they're also significantly more fit than the parent. And then there are three others that we measure as more fit. One is called IRA1, one is RIM15, and one is GPB2.
I have a question concerning the sensitivity of the assay.
Yes.
Why would the assay not be sensitive enough? So did you find this, that if you compete the unrecombined one, that you saw a larger change? And I don't get it, because I think you have inferred the kind of adaptive event also in a similar assay. So why would this be then less sensitive?
So what I mean by that is, you can see we have error bars here. So maybe if we did 10 replicates, we might actually be able to determine relative to, you know, so we do essentially wild type versus wild type as a control, and then single mutation clone versus wild type as the experiment. And the more replicates of those that you do, based on how much error you see or how much variation you see in the measurements, the more able you will be to distinguish one from the other, if indeed there is a difference, right?
But still, the effect size must be relatively large, otherwise you wouldn't have detected it. So for these
mutations, we can see there's a huge effect size, right? We're talking about, you know, 15 to 40% increase in fitness per generation, which is massive.
Yeah, that's why I think it may not be adaptive.
Oh, I agree with you. I think that these things along here are probably neutral, but formally I can't guarantee to you that they are, so I'm not going to say these are guaranteed to be neutral, because someone will put their hand up and say, well, how can you rule out that it's sensitivity in your assay? And I can't without doing lots more replicates, and the experiments are non-trivial and time-consuming. So, you know, we do between 3 and 6 replicates for each of them. And
yeah, but you know the effect size from using the non-recombined one, the upper.
We do. So you can ask the question. You then have to decide, well, what's my model for how individual mutations together will act? So, for example, I've got two mutations here in this red clone, or two mutations here in this yellow clone. How does a fitness effect of 15% and 17% manifest when they go together? Is it additive? Is it multiplicative? Is there an additional epistatic effect between these two? And it would be very easy to argue yourself into saying that these do account for the entire effect when they were together in the same cell, or that they don't. Now, in this case, these were the only mutations, but in this case, you know, there's other mutations that you might say also might have some minor effect, and I can't rule that out.
Yes? I think if I understood correctly your earlier data, it could also be, for example, these last yellow ones that don't show an effect, maybe they would only show an effect if you were competing them with M4.
That is also a very good point. This is all against the wild type, right? And these mutations themselves arose, while I don't demonstrate here exactly when they arose, we have looked at allele frequencies in the population and know that these arise fairly late on. And so if they arose while this was the main competitor in the chemostat, then that effect will be missed here if it was dependent on competing against this particular one. That's also a very good point. Yes?
Do you see overrepresentation of certain combinations of mutation when you look at your sequences, and that's somehow evidence, presumably, for epistasis?
We see. So we only have 5 clones here, so we can't talk about an overrepresentation of combinations. hopefully with more data we might start to see that. What we do see and what I'm going to come to is actually an overrepresentation of absence of combinations.
These fitness effects are really huge.
They are huge.
So are they? Can they be tested sort of by independent growth? This should really be sort of macroscopic differences in growth rate.
Right. So if you
can you do something other than a competitive assay?
You can measure their specific growth rate under some condition, and if it's under low glucose, then yes, you will see significantly large differences between the mutation-carrying clones that are presumably adaptive compared to the wild type. So yes, you can observe those. But kind of the gold standard for experimental evolution is to do the pairwise fitness assay.
Yeah, but of course, usually it's because the fitness differences are relatively small.
Right.
You want to avoid noise, but here it's somehow it's...
Certainly for the ones which are clearly adaptive, the changes in fitness are huge, yes. All right, so back to our list. So I'll get rid of all the things that, at least trivially and singly, are not adaptive. And then concentrate just on these three genes for a second. So IRA1, RIM15, and GPB2. So we have a ready explanation for the hexose transporters and MTH1. They're going to increase the availability of glucose. But how about these three? Well, turns out they are all in exactly the same pathway. This is the RAS protein kinase A signaling pathway. And this pathway basically integrates information about nutrient availability and then coming out with active protein kinase A is the decision to undergo cell division. So where are our mutants? Well, we have a mutation in GPB2 and a mutation in IRA1. GPB2, this was that transposition event, so a transposon inserted itself into the gene, presumably disrupting its function, so we think that's a loss of function. This itself inhibits the activation of protein kinase A, so if we lose this activity here, that inhibition is relieved, and so we predict there'll be more protein kinase A. IRA1 was a non-synonymous substitution. It was actually a conservative change. So I'll put a question mark here as to whether it's a loss of function. We do know actually the residue that was changed is one that the Saccharomyces cerevisiae and Saccharomyces bionis lineages have maintained for at least the 25 million years since their last common ancestor. So tentatively we're thinking it's a somewhat loss of function allele. IRA1 inhibits RAS, it puts it into a GDP bound form. So if there's less activity here, we expect more RAS, which activates adenylate cyclase, results in more cyclic AMP. That inhibits these inhibitory subunits that would end up giving you more active protein kinase A again. So two independent mutations in different lineages result in more activity from protein kinase A. The third one is RIM15. This was a frame shift, so we're predicting loss of function. RIM15 is inhibited by protein kinase A, so loss of function of something that's inhibited is at least phenotypically similar in idea to having more activity of this through that branch of the downstream pathway. So that's three independent mutations affecting this pathway, essentially turning up the output of it. So it suggests that this is a frequent adaptive target under these glucose limiting conditions. All right, so back to our list again, and this gets to...
You say what protein kinase A does?
Protein kinase A, it's... So if you delete it, for example, it's actually made up of these three subunits called TPK1, 2, and 3. If you delete it in yeast, the yeast cells die, and they die at a place in their cell cycle called start, which is the commitment point to cell division. And so its targets are many, although to some extent unknown. So people have done various assays and see that lots of things get phosphorylated in a protein kinase A-dependent manner. But that phosphorylation event appears to be required for commitment to cell division. In its absence, then they won't do it at all. If you delay it, they divide later. So it appears that the cells are essentially saying, we can go ahead and divide when normal cells are saying we're not quite ready to divide yet because we don't have enough carbon source. And it appears under these conditions that that is an adaptive event. Okay, so back to our list of mutations. This gets to your point. We noticed, okay, we had these three MTH1 alleles. They arose relatively early. And then we had these two hexose transporter amplifications that arose later on. But the thing that was striking is that this event didn't occur on one of those backgrounds. Now, the trivial explanation is, well, you're looking at a small number of clones, just randomly it didn't happen, and if you did enough experiments, probably it would. The alternative explanation, which forms our hypothesis, is that those two mutations, while each individually adaptive under these conditions, might actually be mutually exclusive as a result of reciprocal sign epistasis, which would lead us to the question, do the MTH1 mutations and the hexose transport amplifications determine the evolutionary trajectory by constraining the fitness landscape? Now, if we just look at allele frequency, this is just now of the MTH1 allele in the yellow population, and then this is the hexose transporter amplification frequency. You can see, and it's very striking, right? MTH1 increases in allele frequency during the experiment, but at this point, somewhere around the time that the hexose transporter amplification is taking hold, it essentially becomes extinct within the population as the hexose transporter amplification, this is in the yellow population, goes to almost fixation. So this is supportive, although not definitive evidence that there might be some kind of mutual exclusivity. In addition, I told you that we had seen that within the green population there was a hexose transporter amplification. We isolated 2 dozen clones from the end of the experiment from the green population. All of 24 of them had the hexose transporter amplification. None of them had that MTH1 allele that we had observed at the beginning occurring in the green population. So we have at least circumstantial evidence that there's reciprocal sign epistasis. So just to remind you about epistasis. So in all four of the pictures that will come up here, the wild type is denoted in red in uppercase. If there's no epistasis, then we might get two mutations, either an A mutation or a B mutation. If you put them together, then merely you kind of add their increased fitnesses, but there's no kind of additional effect. With magnitude epistasis, the double mutant might have a fitness which is more than the sum of the parts. In the case of sign epistasis, and now the wild type is actually at the bottom here, the double mutant might be more fit than one of the single mutants, but less fit than the other. So it is possible, if you go in this trajectory, to then go here and then to there. So the landscape is not totally constrained. All three of those genotypes are available. But to get over to there actually would require a back mutation if you went via this route. Finally, reciprocal sign epistasis is where each of the single mutations individually more fit, but the double mutant is less fit than either of those, which means that if you go off in one direction, you're unlikely to get over to the other one. So if the other one is more fit, this is kind of like going after the local optimum versus the global optimum. If you have a population size large enough or a mutation rate high enough, it is theoretically possible to go through this fitness valley, but it's much less likely than if you don't have this reciprocal sign epistasis. So, again, being yeast, we can test this empirically. So we take our two mutants, right? One with an MTH1 mutation, one with a hexose transporter amplification, mate them, sporulate, and we're going to get all four possible genotypes out. We're going to get double wild type, the two single mutants, and then the double mutant. And we can compete those in our pairwise fitness competitions against the wild type. We can also compete this against either of the two single mutants, or indeed compete the single mutants against one another. So, the two single mutants, this is essentially a recapitulation of earlier. MTH1 is more fit than the parent. Hexose transporter amplification is more fit than the wild type parent. But the double mutant's not simply less fit than the two singles, it's less fit even than the original wild-type strain itself. Right, so we have empirical evidence of reciprocal sign epistasis constraining the adaptive landscape under these conditions. As you might expect, the double mutant in a head-to-head competition against either of the two singles is also less fit. And if we put the two singles against one another, the hexose transporter amplification is more fit than the MTH1 loss of function. Which leads us to return to this fitness landscape idea. You could imagine each one mutation is going off in one direction and the hexose transporter amplification is going off in the other. In the experiments we've done so far, it appears that the hexose transporter amplification is more fit than the MTH1 mutation and causes this to become extinct. So if you're a lineage that picked up this, because this occurs frequently enough, you're likely doomed to extinction. Although we can't guarantee that that's going to be the case in every experiment we ever do. What we don't know, what would be exciting to find out, is if we set up a chemostat with this mutation already present in 100% of the cells, now, can this ever raise? And if so, is it because with very small chance but large population we got a back mutation here immediately followed by the amplification? Or is there some kind of ridge out of the plane of the screen here that allows these to be connected, containing some kind of compensatory mutations? And we don't know the answer to that yet. We haven't done the experiment. Yes?
So you said earlier that there is no transitivity in the sense that you can actually add fitnesses. I mean, you cannot. I'm sort of worried about the lack of additivity of pairwise fitness comparisons, which means do you really have an absolute measure of fitness for each of your strengths, or does it really depend on what you competed against?
I think. So we do have a measure of fitness. Is it an absolute measure of fitness? No, it's never going to be an absolute measure of fitness. It's always going to be relative. And so that does depend, of course, on then what you compete against.
But then in the extreme, if there's no more landscape left, right? If you don't have transitivity.
So what I imagine, kind of at least as a hypothetical construct, is that as the population evolves, that the landscape itself is constantly changing. Now, what exactly that means from a theoretical standpoint, I don't know. But your ability to compete is always based on what you're competing against as well as the environment within which you find yourself. Essentially, the things that you compete against are part of that environment. And so I think it. Now, the question is, does the landscape change by scaling, in which, you know, peaks and troughs are either amplified or compressed, or does it change by, you know, some kind of tilting, or does the shape change entirely? And we don't have enough empirical data to answer that.
Coming back to the slide where you had the bars when you did the pairwise comparisons.
This one?
Yeah, this one. I mean, so there is a difference in the height of the two.
Between these two?
Yeah.
But and then, why isn't that the same as that, is your question.
Exactly.
A trivial explanation is that it's within the error bars. A non-trivial explanation is that it's not completely additive, and I suspect both of those are true.
And what would explain the non-additivity in that case?
Well, in this case, this hexose transporter amplification clone is competing against something else, which is making more hexose transporters because it's lost function in the repressor. And so the amount of glucose left available within the environment for this to suck up is less than if it were competed against a wild type. The wild type can't really suck up that much, but this one has gotten better at it than wild type. And so, you know, they're in this war with one another, and they've both found ways in which to better take advantage of the available substrate. And so you can see that that's going to change the equation in terms of how much fitter you might be.
So the substrate is being depleted.
Yes. So if you measure, if you have in a chemostat just a monoclonal chemostat with either of these in it compared to a wild type, and you measure the residual glucose concentration present in medium, then you'll find that there's a lot less residual substrate when you have these clones present in it rather than the wild type.
Is there a way of doing this sort of experiment with constant substrate concentrations
throughout the experiment? In theory, I guess one could have some kind of fluorescently labeled substrate and have, you know, some kind of spectrophotometric detection method to try to adjust the amount of substrate being provided constantly to keep the amount of residual substrate the same. We certainly haven't done that. I don't know of anyone else who has. Yeah, theory is great, but when you get into real data, it's just messy.
What do you think is happening molecularly in a double mutant?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's lots of potential answers. So, for example, like the hexose transporters have to be located to the cell membrane. So there's a whole set of machinery for transporting proteins intracellularly to get them to the membrane. So it could be that taking up too many resources in transporting to the membrane prevents other things from being transported on those machinery. It could be that there's a limited amount of real estate on the membrane, so you put too many hexose transporters on it, they preclude other things, or they change the membrane strength or tension. It could be...
What of those mechanisms, which one is particular to the ones that already have the MTH1 mutation on it? Make it more curious.
I'm not sure I follow your question. So if you have this, right, more fit, and you add this, now less fit.
Right.
And so...
But if you have wild type and you add it, you're more fit.
Right, and so there's clearly...
But just putting it out on the membrane and taking more resources...
Is good.
Is good.
Presumably up to a point. Right, and at some point you're doing it at the expense of being able to do other things, be that transport to the membrane or take up membrane real estate or just general devotion of transcriptional resources, etc.
So should Eugene. That be the case, continuing along those lines? This 6-7 amplification of HXT should be somewhere close to the limit.
Uh-huh.
So if you limit them further, you wouldn't be able to obtain an even higher level of amplification. Is that the case?
It might be, but we don't have data to say one way or the other. What we do have data for is, and so a third possibility is that too much glucose somehow being brought into the cell is bad. I don't think that is the case, although I have some data. So this gene is a gene which results in antagonistic pleiotropy. So under limiting glucose, having this mutation is good, right? You become more fit. On the other hand, under sufficient glucose conditions, having this mutation is deleterious and you become less fit. And what you see is if you take these strains and evolve them under sufficient glucose through serial batch transfer, that this will contract back and the amplified version will be expunged from the population as those which, you know, randomly end up with one less copy become selected for. Yes?
Do you see a difference in the different copy numbers?
So if you remember a number of slides ago, we had those two different alleles and they weren't showing exactly the same fitness. And they don't have exactly the same number of copies. So I presume there is some kind of either linear or at least proportionality between the number of copies and the fitness up to some kind of asymptotic point. I presume, you know, once you've got n copies, n plus 1 doesn't make a lot of difference.
If I understood what you were just saying, then you're saying that it could have a deleterious effect if there's too much.
It could do, and so that you might actually have these two opposing forces. And it's hard. Genetically, it's difficult to tease out these things because to genetically manipulate a repeated locus where there's like a dozen repeats is difficult from a genetic engineering point of view. You could, of course, try putting multiple copies of this all around the genome in various different targeted but distinct locations to see how each one might change it and kind of plot fitness versus number and then see whether you get some kind of concave curve. I don't know whether you would get that. It'd be an interesting thing to find out.
In this plot, are they all the same n?
In this plot, yes, they're all the same n. These are all ones derived from the final yellow clone. We've done the same experiments with the ones derived from the penultimate red clone, and we see essentially the same thing. The exact numbers might differ slightly, but we see the same pattern. Okay. Is this relevant to wild yeast? Maybe. It was kind of interesting. We looked at some of the sequenced yeast strains that exist, and there is one denoted here that in MTH1 actually has a stop codon naturally. And we've looked using array CGH to look at copy number across about 70 different wine strains. And we see that there is natural variation in the copy number of hexose transporters, HXT6 and 7. It's tempting to speculate that what we observed in the chemostat has some kind of relevance in the environment. I think that's purely speculation rather than concrete evidence. So how about other interclonal epistasis relationships, right? So it'd be really great if, for example, those three different mutations in that RAS cyclic AMP pathway, which all appear to result in more protein kinase A activity, or at least some facsimile of it, if they also had some kind of reciprocal sign epistasis. So again, we can do this kind of generic thing, generate all of the possible genotypes, compare them to wild type. We don't see any other cases of reciprocal sign epistasis. We do see epistasis, so we see one case here of sign epistasis. So here is the double mutant between RIM15 and GPB2. It's more fit than the RIM15 individual mutant, but it's less fit than the GPB2 mutant. When you combine these various genes, we see a slightly less fit result than we would expect based on the two individual genotypes. So this one obviously is much less, but even in this case here, we see this one's maybe more striking. So the double mutant, if you consider the two single mutants, the double mutant isn't as much fitter as we would predict just from the individual numbers. So we think there is some negative epistasis, but only one additional case where we see something more extreme, in this case sign epistasis, but not, we didn't observe any more reciprocal sign epistasis. So to summarize, in our experiments, I think we've demonstrated that clonal interference is important in adaptive evolution by population dynamics and allele frequencies, as well as the fact that many adaptive mutations that we see early on are essentially lost or nearly lost in the population. It appears that in addition to glucose transport, signaling through the RAS pathway is an important target of adaptation under these conditions. And I believe that mutually exclusive mutations in this experiment, but maybe more generally, play a role in defining the adaptive landscape. So where do we go from here? Well, this comes back to the question of, are any of those supposedly neutral things, are they adaptive in the presence of other mutations? That just requires doing more chemostats. So how general are the adaptations? So we did it under aerobic glucose limitation. So would some of these still be adaptive under anaerobic glucose limitation, or under nitrogen limitation, or acetate limitation? You know, are these generalists or specialists? And then the final question is, what fraction of the adaptive landscape have we explored? And I suspect we've explored a tiny amount of the adaptive landscape. We have these other evolved populations to look at. And then there's also the question of, right, we looked at haploids, but what if we did repeated all of these experiments but with diploids? Would the adaptive mutational spectrum be different or not? So, for example, MTH1 was a loss of function. If that's recessive, maybe you never see that in the diploid as being adaptive. Maybe there's an entirely different spectrum of mutations that provide adaptive benefit in diploids. Yes?
So you say that clonal interference, I guess, rather than sweeps would be important, and you see that from this experiment, but how much of that is based on the constant populations and lack of bottlenecks and environmental uncertainty, which would probably cause a sweep if, I think, times were really bad if there was really strong selection?
Right. So I believe that, I'm saying under our experimental conditions, clonal interference is important. If you did, so we would love to be able to do some kind of microfluidic system with, say, 1,000 cells and start, for example, to look at the effects of drift or even adaptation. And you would predict, although it would take longer because the mutation rate supply is lower, or the mutation supply rate is lower because you've got fewer cells, but you would predict that you'd be much more likely to get a clonal replacement. I don't believe clonal replacement is wrong. I just think it's at one point on the spectrum between clonal replacement all the way through clonal interference to multiple mutations. It's just that most people in chemostats using single-celled organisms, be they eukaryotic or prokaryotic, are working with large populations, not small populations. And so to interpret those data, they need to interpret it in light of interference rather than replacement. So we have all of these are the seven other populations, and they differed in population size. We had four that were 10 to the 8, four that were 10 to the 9, and the one that was down here is the one that we've characterized. And so, you know, the question is, right, we pulled out five adaptive clones. Some of those contained two trivially explainable adaptive mutations. Some of them only contained one. So clearly, we missed some adaptive events because we only pulled out five things rather than enough to account for each of the individual adaptive mutations. But the question is, were there 50 adaptive events? Were there 500 or 5,000 adaptive events? But most of them never really went anywhere. So what we're doing now, for this population in collaboration with ABI, but actually we're just going to do all of these populations now that we have improved sequencing capacity at Stanford, is take, in the case of this experiment, 12 different generation time points and just isolate the population, extract DNA, and sequence that DNA now to 1,000x coverage. And that gives you about a 97% chance of observing any allele that reached a 1% allele frequency. For things that reached a 5% allele frequency, you're pretty much guaranteed to see them. 1%, it's tricky because the error rate of the sequencing technology is also about 1%. So we need to generate empirical error distributions when we just sequence the wild type and use that as a filter for when we sequence these populations. But the question is, how many things will we see that make it up to a 1% allele frequency that kind of wink in and wink out of existence? Will there, you know, be 5, 10, 50, 100? Will we see that when we project those onto pathways, will they all be the RAS cyclic AMP pathway? Will there be other pathways that were weakly adaptive that never made it to some, you know, appreciable size? And then doing this across all of the populations that we generated, are we going to see the same genes again and again have the large effects, or was it just a random chance that in the one we looked at we had MTH1, hexose transporters, and RAS cyclic AMP pathway? So finally, I want to thank the lab. The initial work on this system was done by Katie, who's now an assistant professor at Texas A&M, and then it's been continued by Dan, who's a graduate student in the lab. And thanks for your attention. Yes?
Given these extremely large effect mutations, one might wonder how much depends on the initial condition of your experiment. So with which clone you start, what would happen if you would redo the experiment with an already somewhat adaptive clone that you evolved for 500 generations?
Right.
So within your experiments, do you observe slowing down of evolution where you, big effect mutations don't occur later?
I don't think we have done them for long enough and measured that carefully enough to know whether we see a slowdown. I think one would predict a slowdown. If you look at the Lenski experiments, which of course are very different, right? So they've done E. coli populations through serial transfer, so there is a bottleneck, but they've taken those for 50,000 generations. And definitely the adaptive change you see over time is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. I would suspect one of the experiments we're going to do is to start a chemostat with just MTH1 already fixed in the population. So one thing is we'll find out, are the subsequent changes quite small compared to the, you know, initial one? But in addition, of course, we want to find out, is there this ridge between MTH1 and the hexose transporter amplification through some kind of sequence of compensatory mutations? Yes?
I'm somewhat confused about the role of this large population size, because when a mutant appears, it appears as a single copy.
Single cell.
Yeah. And so there should be a lot of stochastic effects, and actually...
There's definitely stochastic effects. A single cell with a mutation that's adaptive is not guaranteed to expand within the population. It might just get sucked out of the chemostat before it has a chance to take hold. So there's probably many adaptive events that we could never observe, that even though they occurred, you know, they're gone before they have a chance to do anything. So there will be stochastic effects there. What I don't think there are is the ability for adaptive, or the ability for a mutation to expand within the population due to anything other than adaptation or hitchhiking with an adaptive event. I don't think there's any possibility of drift allowing a non-adaptive mutation in the absence of a linked adaptive one to expand within the population. If you have a population size of maybe 1,000, drift would probably play a huge role, and it would be really interesting to look at the effects of drift if you could come up with an experimental system that would allow you to do so. Yes?
Could you just continue this comparison with Lenski? I think, at least for me, it was interesting, which you started answering previous questions. So, one thing which I'm curious about is I looked at this paper reported on full sequencing of Lenski genomes, and one of the genes which received repeated hits in multiple lineages by mutations was something which seemed to control expression levels of genome-wide.
Is this RPOS? Is that the gene?
I forgot which one. It was some kind of gene which was maintaining the overall level of suprachoroidal, right? So my rationale was that if you are trying to subject your bug to conditions which are very different to what it used to, it may be a good strategy to start first changing levels of many things at once with one mutation, and then later refine it by kind of independent mutations in selected genes which you might have missed the mark, either overshooting or... And what you see in your experiment is very different strategies, that all of your repeated mutations are very aimed at a relatively small pathway which is responsible. Right. So could you actually explain it in terms of this different, setups of the experiment, yours being the chemistat and Lenski being going through the model?
I don't know whether we can necessarily explain it as a result of the different experimental strategy. It's entirely possible that the reason we don't see these, so I don't know whether you're familiar with the work of Greg Stephanopoulos. So they've done work where they have this kind of engineering evolution approach, which is called GTME, which is Global Transcriptional Machinery and Expression or something, where they try to evolve things based on tweaking very global regulates. And they do see that they are able to make things more fit by tweaking them. So you can imagine there's kind of global ways by tweaking everything or some large subset of everything, and then there's local ways where it's a specific pathway. Now, it might just be in our particular case that under glucose limitation, there's a handful of large effect mutations which provide way more fitness advantage than tweaking the global machinery. If we had left these going for 5,000 generations, we might see the global machinery start to be tweaked, but we didn't do that.
In terms of sheer number of mutations per generation, per megabase, are you in the same order of magnitude as Lenski, if you recall?
So yeast has a mutation rate of 10 to the minus 10 per nucleotide per generation.
It's about the same as we call
it. It's about 1 in 10,000 cells per generation is expected to get a mutation.
Generation is
about 6 hours. So if you think about it, right, if 1 in 10,000 cells is going to get a mutation, and we've got 10 to the 9 cells, right, so that's 10 to the 5 generation, 10 to the 5 mutations per generation. As we have a 12 megabase genome, about every 100 generations, and you have to consider Poisson sampling, but you might actually see every possible mutation that could ever occur, or at least every nucleotide that could ever be mutated, have a mutation during 100 or so generations worth of time. I don't know exactly how that compares to E. coli, but I suspect it's similar. Yes?
Is there any of these up and down behaviors in the experiment, can they be partially explained by some faster processes like non-genetic processes?
Like some kind of signaling?
Or actually just some silencing of loci that is happening, that is just generating
some epigenetic phenomenon,
just generate some heterogeneity that's being selected on during these shorter time scales, because after all this is 100 generations and those states can propagate for roughly 100 generations. Maybe some component of it.
Yeah, I cannot rule that out. So if you just take a yeast population, I'm pretty certain that there will be variation in, for example, exact nucleosome positioning. And that means there's probably some expression variability, despite the fact that they're kind of clonal. And can you then select upon that? Possibly you can. I cannot rule it out, but we haven't done any experiments to address whether that in fact is a phenomenon that's occurring. Okay, thank you.